Cybersecurity is what keeps me up at night, right? If someone decides to hack into our system, my name is in the paper, my agency's in the paper, and it just brings down the level of confidence that people have in government.
Well, welcome back to the Public Money Pod, a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. And we, of course, proudly sponsored by Odyssey Advisors, MuniPro, the Government Finance Officers Association, and Build America Mutual. I'm Justin Marlowe, and I'm joined, as always, by my intrepid co-host, purveyor of long story short, bona fide fiscal policy expert, and very important to this episode, Californian, Liz Farmer. Liz, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. And as it happens, I'm headed out to California in a couple of days for some work and some family and to go visit family. So with our upcoming guest, I will make sure and send this episode to my folks so they can bone up for our conversations by the time they see me.
That's right. Briefing the family before the visit. Yeah. Always a good idea. Good stuff. Yeah, well, speaking of that special guest, as promised, we have the most recent installation in our State Treasurer series, this time welcoming California Treasurer Fiona Ma. Very excited about this one, of course. Liz, a few weeks ago, we had Gabe Pettick, California's legislative analyst, on telling us about the budget picture in California, which then and now remains pretty grim. Yet, it's always nice to talk to somebody else within California's state financial picture to get a different take. And as often the case, talking to the treasurer is something different from talking to the folks working on the budget or the tax policy side of the house. So we're really looking forward to getting into some of that with her, as well as some of the really interesting, I think, questions about what the state treasurer's office there is doing programmatically, and some interesting questions about her and her unique background. When we think about the California state treasurer's office, Liz, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, it's just everything. Everything in California is on a much bigger scale. I think we have in our show notes that the treasurer in California manages a $4 trillion in state and local public money, which is about the size of the entire municipal bond market. I mean, it's just talk about Texas, but everything's bigger in California too.
Yeah, indeed. As much cash as will flow through the entire municipal bond market, hundreds of billions of dollars of borrowing for infrastructure all over the place. If I remember correctly, the California State Treasurer serves on something like 14 boards and commissions, including and especially the boards of CalPERS, the main state public employment retirement system, CalSTRS, the teachers' retirement system. I mean, you're just talking about trillions and trillions of dollars of public money. So it's such an important office. Really, really looking forward to getting her perspective and having one more treasurer to add to our now running series here at the Public Money Pod, where we talk to some of the most important people in all of state and local public money, and that is state treasurers. Well, we are pleased to welcome to the Public Money Pod California Treasurer Fiona Ma. Treasurer Ma, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you. We've heard a lot about California's budget deficit and challenges in that area. But let's look beyond the immediate few months and year, and can you kind of talk about California's financial position overall, particularly how it did during the pandemic?
Yeah, great. This is my fourth elected position. I started on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 2002, and we had a recession back then. Then in the Assembly 2006 to 2012, we went through the Great Recession, and then things were pretty stable for a while, and then now COVID as the state treasurer. And I was really surprised, as everybody was home every day. After the first year, we had a $46 billion surplus. We're like, how did that happen? Well, number one, everyone was home, so nobody was traveling. People were still buying motorhomes, trucks, boats, right? They were still shopping online, eating online. I mean, everything was still here in the city, in the state. And then the tech companies, because of COVID, right, all of a sudden, they were exploding. And so the tech companies were hiring people. They were still offering stock options and bonuses, mergers, acquisitions, right? Lots of new startups. And interest rates were low. So people were buying and selling homes, commercial properties, stocks. Everyone was home. They all opened up a Robinhood account, right? So people were reporting capital gains. And California is highly dependent on personal income tax, corporation tax, and sales taxes. So all three of them were doing well during the pandemic. Then the next year of the pandemic, we're still kind of on lockdown, right? People are still staying around for the most part. And we faced a $95 billion surplus. So $45 billion in the first year of COVID, $95 billion in the second year. That is the highest surpluses the state has ever had, continuing on those same trends, right? People were, you know, worried that interest rates were going to drop, right? Federal COVID assistance money was going to go away. So people were like still, right, spending, which is great. Then post-COVID now, we are facing about a $50 billion deficit. People said, what happened? Why did things change? Well, tech companies, as we know, have been laying off people. There aren't that many mergers and acquisitions. People aren't selling. The stock market is, you know, all over the place. Interest rates have been rising. So people are not buying and selling homes and companies and strip malls and all that. And then we faced a 6-month Writers and Actors Guild strike. Hollywood brings a lot of money to California, not only the production, the actors, and all of the ancillary businesses, the hairdressers, the caterers, right? Even the secondhand stores were complaining because of the strike, because people would go, props, right, looking for all things to put in the movies. And so they were always booming. And so once you turn off Hollywood, it's very hard to turn them back on because they've already made deals shooting in other states and in other countries. So those are the reasons that we had a slowdown. Now, interest rates, I understand they had a meeting today. They think they may lower the rates in the fall or at the end of the year. We really need them to lower the rates sooner. Lots of capital is sitting on the sideline waiting. And I speak at a lot of different investment forums, private equity and others. And they're like, we think it's almost time to get back in, right? Whether it's commercial property or housing or investment, but they're still waiting. So this fiscal year, we end our fiscal year June 30th. We're definitely going to have a big deficit, but hopefully the next year rates will drop, right? The presidential election will be behind us. Investors have to kind of deploy capital because they have to make their rate of return for their investors, right? They can't sit on the sideline too long. So they are looking around for those gems. And Hollywood is back. AI is trending right now. And many of the AI engineers, investors, they're coming to California, San Francisco in particular. They're right now at the outskirts of downtown. But as they expand, they're going to go back downtown. And hopefully we'll bring back some of our workers. Our state workers are still only required to work 2 days a week, whereas many of the private companies now are 3, 4, and some of the companies are even back at 5 days a week. And so hopefully things are going to kind of come back to normal in the next fiscal year.
Sure. All that makes good sense. You mentioned interest rates. As I understand it, California is looking at something like $100 billion worth of borrowing over the next several years for everything, right? For housing, for school buildings, for a whole range of capital projects. Have you adjusted at all your maybe immediate plans for that borrowing, given what's been happening in the credit markets?
Yeah. So right now, the state is expected to borrow somewhere around $100 billion in the next few years to finance all of those different type of projects. This March, voters voted to support Proposition 1, which is a $6 billion mental health bond to help with more services, construction, renovation, building of more mental health facilities. So that's $6 billion. The governor has instilled a cap of about $26 billion in new bonds, which we support. So we work very closely with the governor's office and the controller's office. We're like the three control agencies. And so we definitely support that. And we don't and won't borrow anywhere in that $100 billion in any given year, because as you know, when you issue bonds, they are kind of at the top of the list. And we need to make sure we have enough operating revenues for all of our other programs and services.
How will interest rates affect potentially the time of borrowing for those projects? Assuming, I guess, the $10 billion bond passes as well.
Well, I mean, we're all very sensitive to interest rates, just like you as a consumer. When rates are too high, you're not going to buy a house. You're not going to buy a car. Right now, car loans are at 10%, and it just slows everything down. And so, you know, we also, every day, we invest the state's idle funds. It's about $150 million today, and we are competing with every other state, local governments for money that is safe, liquid, that has yield, right? And so we are, you know, in the market every day watching and competing. And so, you know, interest rates obviously do trigger a lot of different decisions that government and individuals make.
Treasurer, we talk often on this podcast about cybersecurity. What more can you tell us about some of the cybersecurity, you know, measures and initiatives that your office is doing to deal with what seems like this just threat that we hear more and more about all the time?
Yeah. So we are learning that every day there are cyber terrorists that are out there, and they are always going to be one step ahead of us, right? Because they are focused 24/7 on hacking and breaking into our systems. We had a recent break-in to our CalPERS retiree system, and they apparently got a lot of data from this company that did a lot of business with different states, and they couldn't easily sort out which state and what person lived where, which was good. But if you gave them more time, they probably would have figured it out. And that's where they can hold a state or a company ransom, because they actually know what the pool is. So in that case, we were kind of lucky that they weren't able to do those sorts. And so it was very hard for them to really access data the way they would like to. Cybersecurity is what keeps me up at night, right? If someone decides to hack into our system, my name is in the paper, my agency's in the paper, and it just brings down the level of confidence that people have in government, right? So what have we done? We work with the military. We have a military audit every 2 years. We work with the California Department of Technology on their exercises like phishing attacks, ransomware, data breaches, inside threats, right? So we do try to prepare ourselves, but they're not the most sophisticated. We have to do more employee training and awareness programs. We have to hire outside companies to do advanced security technologies like firewalls, intrusion detection systems, prevention systems, encryption of data, and then obviously the regular security audits and vulnerability assessments. I think it must be part of every government agency now to take this seriously, because once that data is breached, that becomes a huge liability for government, but also for the individuals whose information is out there on the dark web.
Maybe if we could shift to a slightly more less ominous topic. You've also been a leader in borrowing for green infrastructure investments and managing money with an eye towards those types of environmentally friendly investments. Can you maybe talk about that? Share some highlights, and also what are some of the challenges that come along with the borrowing and investing in the green space?
Yeah, so when I got elected about 6 years ago, part of my job is to sign off on, it's called the Appendix A, or the prospectus that goes out for investors who are buying our bonds. And one of the bonds said green bond in parentheses. And so I asked my deputy, I go, what's the definition of a green bond? And he goes, ah, that's a really good question, right? So if it looks like a pig, it smells like a pig, well, we just assume that it is a pig, right? And that what was happening back then is that we were issuing a water infrastructure, clean water bond. So they called it a green bond, but it wasn't defined. Kind of like what happened in the agriculture space, right? When organics first came to the market and people would just say, we're selling an organic product. And you would say, well, what does that mean? And then it took years for them to develop, right? You have to clear the land. You can't use certain, you know, pesticides and fertilizers, and it has to blah, blah, blah. And so now when a consumer buys an organic product at the supermarket and it says organic, we know as consumers what that means. So I said, we need to define green, because I don't want to say it's a green bond and someone asked me that, what is the green bond? So we developed the California Green Bond Market Development Company committee and worked with UC Berkeley on this collaboration. We invited about 24 experts from different sectors of the bond market and got them to sit and try to figure out a definition for green bonds. And after about 3 years, because we did have COVID, the subcommittee did make recommendations. And so now when someone asks me what a green bond is, we do have some definitions of a green bond. So thank you for asking me about that. Some of the challenges are how green is a green investment. Some of them are combinations. When you issue a bond, it's not usually just for one thing, but it is for a number of different infrastructure projects. So you can't call the whole bond a green bond if only one or two items that are being financed are not green. So I think that is the challenge, or at least in the prospectus, you can outline which projects are green so that investors that are looking for more green investments at least say, okay, may not be 100% green, but at least 50% of the projects are green. And so I'm feeling more comfortable to put it in my portfolio. So that's number one. Number two, I do think there are more investors that want to invest in more green projects, right? So the appetite is out there. And now those type of investments are showing competitive returns. I think that was one of the rumors back then, is like, oh, well, the green bond, the ESG, the DEI, you know, those companies that focus on it, well, they're not making money. And our fiduciary duty is to make sure we make that 6% or 7% rate of return. And if they're not consistently doing it, then maybe we shouldn't invest in those projects. But I feel like this generation, our new generation, they don't want to work for companies that are not looking after their best interests. If they don't like the way the company policies are, they don't like the leadership, the board of directors are not diverse, their hiring practices are not fair and equitable, they will quit. I believe our fiduciary duty is to make sure that these companies are going to be around for the long term. And that means making sure their policies align with this next generation who is super, super focused on the companies they work for.
We've talked, Treasurer, to several state treasurers on this podcast, and this question of ESG comes up often. There's strong opinions on, I guess you could say, across the continuum around whether, as you mentioned, your fiduciary responsibility can be upheld and at the same time be investing and borrowing consistent with ESG principles. Do you have a take on that?
I'm in California. California has taken the lead in climate change with AB 32 that was passed and signed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger back in 2006 that sought to limit the amount of CO2 emissions back to 1980 levels, right? And we have consistently met those goals. Governor Gavin Newsom has set a goal of selling all passenger vehicles to be all electric by 2035. And that really has created a huge market and opportunity for us here in California for the electric vehicle cars, manufacturers, the batteries, the charging stations. And it's not just electric, because I think we're looking at other resources as well, like hydrogen. For the ships or the bigger trucks or the trains, right? I have been a leader at CalSTRS to stick with my young climate guardians. They range from 20 to 18. They used to come to every CalPERS finance, CalSTRS finance committee and ask us to divest. It wasn't a lot of money either. Divest from some of the bad fossil fuel companies. Now, not all fossil fuel companies are the same. Many here in California, because of all the pressures and the goals and the mandates, have actually changed and converted and invested a lot of their money so that they can clean and green and transition into this green economy. So we applaud them for that. They also employ a lot of labor folks. And sometimes, you know, these companies and these plants are in areas where they need these high quality jobs. So we don't want to put anybody out of business. But there are companies that don't want to invest or move or clean and green. And those are the companies that we have to continue to put pressure on. So that's why we do have a divest contingent. Senator Lena Gonzalez also authored a bill that would require CalPERS and CalSTRS to divest from certain type of companies. And until we put, unless we put the pressure on the bad actors, they are not going to change. And so I am part of kind of that divest movement.
A quick follow-up on that, because this comes up so often with ESG and particularly when it comes to pension investing. But how do you approach the fiduciary role when it comes to, you know, making those decisions when you're looking at both the long term but also return for the members in the pension plan?
We are looking for the long term. 30, 40, 50 years. People used to retire at 55. Their life expectancy was 65. Now they retire at maybe 62 and our life expectancy is 92, right? So with that comes obviously more pressure to be fully funded, making our 7%, 6.8% returns at CalPERS and CalSTRS. And that means we need to look at alternative investments, besides just stocks and bonds and real estate, but really looking into the private equity sector, because those traditionally return a greater percent. And during COVID and post-COVID, or during the 2 years in COVID, we made double-digit returns both at CalPERS and CalSTRS, just like many of the investors sitting at home, right? So we did really well. It's done well because we are on a moving average. It's not just 1 year picture. We look at 1 year, 5 year, 10 years, 15 years, and out. So we have to make sure that we kind of smooth that curve in terms of our rate of return. And I believe my fiduciary duty is to look also for the viability of these long-term companies, like I mentioned, right? If we are just looking at short-term all the time, that is not going to work. And I'll give you an example. About 10 years ago, CalPERS wanted to reinvest in tobacco stocks. We have spent so much effort and, you know, advocacy to get people off of tobacco here in California. And the fact that they were thinking about going back in because of the rate of return that these tobacco companies were generating worldwide goes against some of the policies, the health and safety, right? If we are also looking and paying for the health care for our retirees, we should be trying to protect it and make sure that they're living a healthier life now so that in the future, our healthcare costs would go down as well. So it just went against everything that many of us stood for. And so we had to fight against it. Do I feel like that was the right policy move? Yes, I do. If we went back into tobacco stocks, that means we are saying as Californians that we are okay with people being addicted to tobacco. And like I mentioned, these young people are going to be in the workforce working for the next, 30, 40 years. And they don't want to work for companies that are just not doing the right thing. So it has to be multidimensional, environment, social, governance. The young people all care about that.
Well, speaking of the next generation, I was wondering if we could talk a bit about CalKids. We've talked to several state treasurers, and we see this kind of thing happening all over. Tell us a little bit about California's efforts to encourage savings and asset building early on.
Yeah, I mean, I really applaud Governor Gavin Newsom and the legislature for thinking about how to break those cycles of poverty. Mm-hmm. And it starts with family generational wealth. If you don't own a home, you cannot build equity, right? If you're renting and just living hand to mouth for 50 years, you're just never going to make it, right, to that next generation, for the next generation. So they put $2 billion into CalKids accounts back in 2019. And this money is intended for the next generation to save for college or certified apprenticeship programs. So every newborn, regardless of income, born after July 1st, 2022, is eligible for anywhere from $75 to $175 in their CalKids account. So this is newborns. We give them the money, and for 18 years, it'll grow to whatever that amount is. But we really are encouraging the parents to open up a ScholarShare 529. Mm. That is our California savings account program, so that this money is growing and that is free to them, but they could put more money into that account. And I always give the latte example. If you forego a latte a day and put in $100 a month for 18 years, that money could grow to $68,000.
Wow.
Right? With compounding interest, right? And you think about it, you're like, wow, 18 years. Who thinks about 18 years? But, you know, it's kind of this model, set it and forget it. Mm-hmm. You deduct it out of your paycheck. And these days, nobody has a paper paycheck. We just look at our bank account every month and say, oh, that's how much money we have. So the more money you put aside, get it out of your account and save, and just know that you only have this amount to spend every month, right? That is going to help these next generations stay out of high student loan debt. In addition, every first through 12th grader on free and reduced lunch will get $500 in their account. If they're a foster youth, they'll get another $500. And if they're homeless, they'll get another $500. So this is potentially $1,500 in free money. All the parents or guardians have to do is claim their money. It is sitting in an account with the kid's student ID number. Once they click on, answer a couple questions, that money sits in their account until 26 years old.
Wow.
If they don't use the money by 26, then the money will revert back into the account so that other young people can use it. So this is a $2 billion commitment allocation that came out of our surpluses, where the governor and the legislature were able to kind of fund projects that are aspirational and we know will work and encourage parents to save. So calkids.org. We're very happy that during COVID, more accounts were open, ScholarShare 529 accounts. We also chair the CalABLE accounts. That's for people with disabilities to be able to also save for some medical necessity. And then we also have CalSavers for people who work for a company that are not provided a retirement savings account. This is like their own Roth IRA. And again, we have gone back and done, you know, press conferences and people look at their accounts and they couldn't believe that there was so much money in the account because they didn't necessarily log on to CalSavers every day. They don't have a paper paycheck where mm-hmm. they know how much is going in. And then, you know, 4 years later, they're like, wow, I want to put more money into this account because I didn't even know, because people don't know. You get a parking ticket in San Francisco, that's $695 that you don't necessarily have. Your car breaks down, right? All these things cost money that you didn't necessarily save for. So it is working. It is never too early or late to save.
Treasurer, you mentioned home ownership is also one of the big building blocks to building wealth. I think we all know that housing affordability is a big issue in California. We've talked about it before on the podcast, and you've got that bond issuance that's waiting to be approved in the state legislature that I think might help pay for some projects like that. But are there, maybe if you want to talk a little bit more about that, or are there other financial tools that you don't have that you think could help these efforts?
I chair the bond allocation and tax credit committees. that goes to subsidize affordable housing. And over the past 5 years, the governor, Gavin Newsom, has allocated an additional $500 million in state low-income housing tax credits that we leverage with our bonds. So we have passed or approved more housing applications than ever before, really focused on extremely low and very low individuals in the new construction space. So new construction, as you know, is much more expensive than retrofitting or renovating existing programs. But we felt with this additional boost from the state and the federal government gave us two rounds of federal 9% tax credits to be used to help those homeowners that were displaced due to the fires. We had massive fires from 2017 to 2022. And Congressman Mike Thompson, Congressman Jimmy Panetta gave us two rounds of federal 9% so that we could help those devastated by the fires build back sooner. So lots has been put aside for very low, extremely low. The last 2 years, the governor and the legislature set aside money for free down payment assistance up to 20% of the home to any first-time home buyer. The first year it opened, that program opened and closed in 2 weeks. So we said, whoa, who are the people that got it? Well, they may not be the people, the target population, right, to break those cycles of poverty. So now this newest round that's coming is for first-time home buyers whose parents don't own a home, because we understand that that's how you build equity. So we allocate free, no interest, points, fees upfront, and we recoup the money when the homeowner sells their property or refinances after 2 times. So it is really an incentive for them to have that down payment, to live in that house for as long as they can, and then pay us back so that the money goes into a pool for other ones, other people. So it's a great program, highly popular. In the meantime, we need to do a better job in that middle income, because if they can't afford to live in California, they have options. They're going to move. And that's what we did see during COVID. People who could retire early, people who didn't have to come into the office every day, people who couldn't afford to buy a house in LA or San Francisco, but could buy a house in other states, right? So this is a very real phenomenon. And we just in California, that is our number one priority, is housing, housing, housing throughout the state. But it's not always easy just to build and create housing, as you all know.
Treasurer, you have one of the more, I think it's fair to say, interesting backgrounds of state treasurers out there. Trained as an accountant, worked as an accountant for a while. In fact, had your own practice for a little while, but also a member of the Screen Actors Guild and also a big supporter of California's agriculture. The last piece of that, I think, is particularly interesting to those of us in the public money world. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your support for California agriculture and what role the state treasurer's office plays in that.
Yeah. So we all elected officials come to this role only as maybe a specialist or an expert in their own area. So for me, I'm a real estate tax accountant by training. That is what I am comfortable, real estate, hospitality industry, but everything else is a learning experience. I was born in New York, grew up on Long Island, in Great Neck, Long Island. We didn't have a lot of agriculture in Long Island. Then I moved to San Francisco. We don't have a lot of agriculture, you know, maybe cannabis, but back then, not a lot of agriculture. So when I got elected to the state legislature in 2006 to 2012, the meat and potatoes really is in the committee. It's not when the bill gets on the floor, right? Because if you're a Democrat, your colleague's a Democrat, they got the bill to the floor, you're probably going to vote for it, right? Because you have bills and you want your colleagues, and you assume that they've done the compromising in the committee. It is not easy to get a bill to the governor's desk without a lot of compromise. Mm-hmm. So that's where the rubber meets the road, is in the committee. So I tried to sit on as many committees as I could. I think I sat on 18 different committees. So agriculture was one that I said, I have no idea about agriculture. I want to sit on it. My office was like, why are you going to waste your time on the ag committee? They're mostly Republicans. You know nothing about it. Your learning curve is going to be steep. And I was like, okay, I want to do it. This came after Governor Schwarzenegger, to try to balance the budget after 2008. He wanted to sell some of our fairground property. We have about 78 fairgrounds in California. They are like the jewel. They were the main place where people gathered, right? And he wanted to sell the Cow Palace, which was in my district. So I had two people come to my office. It was the Grand National Rodeo time, and they came in with their cowboy hats, and they were all like ready to go, and they just stopped in my office before the Grand National Rodeo started. It was a Friday, and they explained Cow Palace, number one agriculture district association. The cows used to come by rail. They would walk up Geneva to the Cow Palace, where that was where, you know, they would be shown and sold. And I didn't even know about that, right? Because I didn't grow up here. So I said, well, why didn't you invite me to your rodeo? And they're like, oh, you want to come? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, all right, can you be there in an hour and a half? I was like, okay. So I got there close to 6 o'clock, and people saw me and they're like, you need to run. I'm like, run where? They're like, you need to go down, you know, to the paddock right over there. So they would lead me down. They got me a hat. And I said, okay, guys, I'm here. And they're like looking around. There were 6 horses. They were ready to go for the opening. And he looks at this young girl and says, you down. Looked at me, you up on the horse. I kicked off Christy Yamaguchi off of her horse. I felt so bad. I'm like, I am so sorry. Like, I will give you back your horse in a minute, I think, right? So I got on the horse. And they run back and they like change the announcement and they go, and here is our state assemblywoman, Fiona Ma. She is going to save the Cow Palace. So as you imagine, I'm like waving and they're telling the crowd that I'm going to save the Cow Palace. Everybody goes crazy. I get off the horse. I feel like I'm set up, right? But I said, you know what? Game on. I need to save the Cow Palace. And so we did save the Cow Palace from being sold. And that started my path down agriculture, saying I didn't know anything about it. I need to learn. And I learned that we produce 400 different products in California. We are the breadbasket for the nation. We provide so many products to the rest of the world. And I said, wow. So 10 plus years later, after COVID, I am so committed to making sure that we continue to produce our food, which is the freshest, the highest quality, trusted around the world, that we continue to produce food here in California. Because once you pave over farmland, it will never go back to being an agriculture producing piece of property.
For all of our listeners from before that recent year, Christy Yamaguchi, of course, famous Olympic figure skater, just as a point of reference for everyone.
yes, many gold medals.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to join us here on the Public Money Pod. California Treasurer Fiona Ma, we really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful 40 minutes. And, you know, thank you for inviting me and just giving me a little time to talk about California and myself.
Well, thanks again to Treasurer Fiona Ma. That was such a surprisingly wide-ranging conversation, especially at the end there. We really did cover a lot of ground across a large state. The Ripped from the Headlines piece I pulled to go with this interview today actually references, the Treasurer referenced the $10 billion housing bond that's currently up for consideration in the state legislature. The story talks about that amid a larger state borrowing grab. This is from the Sacramento Bee, and it came out in April, and its title is California Bond Could Raise $10 billion for Housing. Can it survive a state borrowing grab? And it's by Lindsay Holden. And it mentions that voters weren't too enthusiastic. It says they barely approved Proposition 1 back in March, which provides 6.4, which will provide $6.4 billion for mental health treatment. I guess it narrowly passed. There's legislation now to put a $10 billion bond for affordable housing and home ownership programs on the November ballot, but it's competing with a handful of other bond proposals in the legislature. And some of those include billions in bond dollars, bond money to combat fentanyl addiction, address climate change, modernize school campuses. These are not small things, and certainly all of them, it's hard to pick and choose in terms of what's the priority. The bond bill for housing is sponsored by Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks from Oakland, and specifically it would raise money for a number of housing programs, including those funding rental and supportive developments, home loans and farm worker and tribal housing. And the measure is currently in the Senate Appropriations Committee. The story mentions California's budget deficit as well, and it also quotes Assembly Speaker Robert Rivas, who said it's unlikely all these legislative bond measures are going to make it to the ballot. And it quotes him talking about being strategic in what the assembly puts before voters, referencing that the March and November elections are different ballgames in regards to voter turnout. So this quotes him saying that long-term investments are really important, especially if we're going to ask taxpayers to foot the bill. And so we've got to be very thoughtful in what it is we're going to pursue. So it's an interesting story that kind of lays out just all the desired spending that California has. We talked about California being a large state with all of the same issues that other states have, but it has to spend a lot of money. It makes a lot of money, but it has to kind of really tackle these at a very, very large scale. And so just $10 billion for housing. We talked about the $100 billion goal over the next however many years, but this is just a lot of money going into the municipal market at some point, assuming some or all of these things eventually get approved. Justin, what are some of the takeaways you had after looking at this story?
Yeah, I'm glad you picked it. It's a really interesting piece. Same as your reaction, the scale, just the scope of all of the different things that we're talking about being debt financed, California state government in the not too distant future. What struck me about this was it was really interesting to see all of these different potential policy initiatives talked about kind of alongside one another. And one of the things that really comes through here, and I think we're starting to see this in a lot of other places, is this notion that housing affordability has to come before all of these other issues. It really, we talk all the time in public policy about having a theory of change, right? Having an understanding from research or from some experience or whatever it might be, having an understanding of what leads to what, what lever you pull that leads to the change that you're looking to make and why that is the case, right? And clearly what seems to be happening here is you have policymakers in California saying that housing affordability has to come before pretty much all these other policy initiatives, because if you don't have housing affordability, you're not going to move the needle on a lot of these other policy initiatives. It's going to be very difficult to improve the quality of public schools if teachers have no place to live. It's going to be very difficult to try to make the case for better investments in climate adaptation if people can't be convinced that they can live in the communities that are being saved by investments in climate adaptation, particularly in coastal communities. It's very difficult to make the case for improving concerns about things like fentanyl addiction and the opioid crisis and a lot of those other issues when so much of those issues clearly are tied to people being in the streets, people being unhoused, people being unsheltered, and then having to spend on all of the social services related to that, to the extent that having housing affordability can address a lot of those issues before they become really big concerns is another reason to invest in housing affordability first. So it really does kind of make very clear the sequencing, right? The ordering of these investments and whether California has come out explicitly or not and said housing has to come first. Treasurer Ma made very clear in her remarks that they see it as the number one priority. And I think a lot of other places are starting to kind of make that same realization and buy into that same theory of change. I don't know that everybody agrees with that. In fact, you could probably make the case that there's a better theory of change. There might be something else that should come first. But what this article makes clear and what a lot of Treasurer Ma's comments make clear is that housing affordability is going to come first, and that's the horse that they're prepared to ride. Thanks again to our Season 2 sponsors, Build America Mutual, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and the Government Finance Officers Association. The Public Money Pod is a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, where we are proudly produced by Hannah Burnick. You can learn more about the center and its work at munifinance.uchicago.edu. That's munifinance.uchicago.edu. You can learn more about Liz Farmer's work at her Substack, Long Story Short. That's Long Story Short. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Public Money Pod.